the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We are the greatest pod, Brooke, in North Carolina, I think. I'm just declaring that today. In this discussion, we are going to talk quarantine birthdays, Cooper's press conference, which happened today. We're recording on a Thursday, and attack on homeschoolers. So, Brooke, how is it going? Let's jump into this birthday stuff. I had a birthday. Your son had a birthday. How is it handling the birthdays for the stay-at-home order?
Well, you know, I think that this is a brave new world that we're living in, and birthdays are certainly being celebrated and observed in different ways. I mean, as are other holidays, such as Easter. But for our family, my son turned 14 years old, and so we had a driveway birthday party with him. And so my sister and her husband, who live about 5 miles from us, drove by with their bodies, and they stopped in front of our driveway with their bodies outside of their sunroof, and they threw rolls of wrapped toilet paper at my son as he was a moving target. And then we played relay race games with the toilet paper up and down our driveway. So that's how we celebrated our birthday. What about you?
But your sister still and her husband still stopped to hang out, right?
I mean, they hung out, but they didn't get out of their car.
Oh, really?
They're afraid.
They're that strict, huh? No intermingling.
Oh, they're very good at social distancing. Even though my sister is super outgoing and very extroverted, they have taken the social distancing orders very seriously and so are observing them far better than I am, I must admit. But it was so much fun. So we set a gift bag at the end of our driveway next to our garage, and we all tried to play basketball or, you know, shoot the toilet paper rolls into the gift bag. And so that was really fun. And then we had to put the toilet paper rolls between our legs, and we had to waddle to the other end of the driveway to see who could do it the fastest. So it was me competing against my four kids. And I just need to say that I won.
My birthday was last weekend.
And wait, did you hear that I won?
You won the shooting contest?
No, you weren't even listening to me. I won the relay contest where you have the toilet paper.
I thought you guys were shooting toilet paper into the hoop.
Yes, and then we had the other relay contest, which I had to tell you about so I could say that I won. And I won it.
Well, I'm proud of you.
But okay, now you can talk about your birthday.
I'm proud of you, Brooke. I will make a certificate for you. And you can put it up in your office.
Like the other certificate you made for me, which is I'm looking at right now. It says Pope Foundation Awards, Brooke Medina. What does it say? Honorable mention for best dressed.
Well, not everybody can win. You know, some people have to be honorable mention.
Ray, you're just so generous with your compliments. Okay, go ahead and tell me about your birthday. What'd you do?
Well, it was really good. I smoked ribs. They were probably the best ribs that I smoked. Started in the oven at 200, went onto the grill after a few hours and just slow smoked them. And they were perfect. Birthday at home. Ooh, I didn't have any friends drive by. I did have some of Kelly's friends from work Zoom me. That's how sad it is. Like Kelly's friends had to Zoom me for my birthday.
Aww.
And then my neighbor, Catherine, it was her birthday too. She was having a party. She had a few people over, but she also had some people drive by. So I pretended like they were my drive-by people. So I went out and waved to them and was just like, you know.
Ray, that sounds so pitiful.
And my three-year-old thought it was his birthday. So he was really excited about my birthday.
Hey, why don't you tell our audience that I sent you I sang happy birthday to you.
You did. It was very, you were like one of the first people that I got a birthday call from. So I did get some calls from family members and so forth. So, but you were, I think, one of the first to chime in. So I do appreciate that.
Thank you. I just felt like we needed to let our audience know about that. So
absolutely.
Oh man, it's so different doing anything during quarantine. But I mean, like I felt so bad for my 14-year-old because he doesn't get to have friends over very often since a lot of his friends live a ways away. And you know this, I know this, as military kids, a lot of our friends have moved in and out of our lives. And so a lot of his friends don't even live over here. And then those that do live a couple towns over. And so he was so disappointed about that. But then he was able to, you know, have my sister and her husband stop by, and he enjoyed that. And then we did a family birthday party. And he got to eat lots and lots and lots of pizza and cake. So, you know, that makes a 14-year-old boy happy.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully this is something he looks back on and says, maybe it wasn't the best or most exciting birthday I ever had, but, you know, just it's a time to remember how close you are to your family and how much your family means to you and the people that are just really close to you and that you're around day to day, and how you can experience that. And it sounds like he's mature enough that he'll probably be one of those people that responds in that way.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But hey, so speaking of quarantines, we just heard Governor Cooper's press conference. We were discussing it, you know, and just shooting back some thoughts, because a lot of his press conference was vague, I'd say, in terms of he presented a plan, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes here, of when North Carolina was going to get to reopen. But still, everything just still seems a little nebulous, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think I told you and Donald this, but I think it's obvious that there's going to be a segment of the population in North Carolina that was, I think, willing to wait till May 1st. They had that in their mind. And I think a lot of people, Brooke, feel like the goalposts keep moving on this. And so, you know, the effort was to not overwhelm the hospitals. We've done that pretty much everywhere. I know that we had some close calls in New York City, but pretty much everywhere in the nation, there hasn't been an overwhelming force or impact or floodgates hitting the hospitals. You know, a lot of nurses have been sitting home on furloughs, especially ones that do more routine or outpatient procedures that were scheduled maybe months in advance, and those haven't happened. But I mean, the point is that people feel like the goalposts have been moved because it was all about not overwhelming the hospitals. And I think a lot of people thought we were going to move forward at least in a more aggressive stint after May 1st. And it seems like in some respects, we're just either moving the goalposts or maybe even going backwards. It kind of feels like Groundhog's Day. We're reliving the same experience to keep moving the goalposts back. So I think a lot of people are going to be frustrated from that. And just watching the press conference, I just felt kind of discouraged. And I'm not someone who gets overly discouraged about things. I tend to have a pessimistic or nature to begin with, or I tend to be a little bit you know, search out the bad news and just expect it. Yeah, just skeptical of things. And I just felt kind of a sense of doom and gloom a little bit because, like you said, it was vague. I think it's hard to understand. You know, you got this phase one tier that we have to hit these specific benchmarks. If we don't hit them by phase one, then it's unclear what happens at that point. Are we punting another few weeks? Are we punting 3 weeks? You know, do we have to hit all these specific benchmarks before we can move on? And there's so many variables and questions in that, because I think it's obvious at this point that more people were exposed than have been, of course, tested. We know that for certain. There's been a lot of evidence and people have written on that this may have been around in at least January and February to a large degree. There's a lot of people that have antibodies already built up. So all of this is just so confusing, Brooke. I don't know. I'm sure you get the same sense in all of this.
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. I think that the public in general would the way that some on one end of the aisle of this, and not just necessarily the political aisle, but aisle when it comes to this virus, some people are of the mindset, like, if you want to lift the stay-at-home orders, you must want people to die. So there's that extreme. And then there's the others that are some, frankly, even denying that a virus exists. They think that it's kind of media ginned up, which is crazy. I actually had my daughter come home from work and told me of a guy who came up to their work and asked to be let inside. And he just was denying that a virus even existed. He pretended like people weren't actually dying from it. And so you've got these two extremes. Mm-hmm. And then there's most of us who are reasonable, rational people. And we're just saying, look, we've got the capacity now in our hospitals to meet the needs. It's been clear that that's the case, thank God. But people are literally losing their livelihoods and shuttering their businesses for good at this point. By June 1st, we're not even sure if, you know, I don't know what percentage of small businesses will be able to stay afloat. And so we recognize that there needed to be some significant mitigation measures employed at first, especially because we didn't have a lot of data. And so we were kind of, you know, working sure. just off of the best guesses. But now we have a lot more information. And yet we're still probably the slowest moving state in the Southeast.
The tortoise and the tortoise and hare race. But I don't know if we're going to have a good outcome on an economic path. And it's still unclear on a health impact how we're going to do. So I'm with you 100% on that. It just feels like we're not moving fast enough. And you're right. I mean, this whole idea that, you know, it's one extreme or the other is frustrating to a lot of people. I think the amount of people that are deniers have massively shrunk. I don't think this is like the flu. This is more dangerous than the flu. Totally agree with that. It's possible, though, with the number of people exposed, that the mortality rate could be more similar to the flu than what we thought. Mm-hmm. Now, in saying that, I'm not saying this is like the flu. I agree that there's certain vulnerable populations that are much more at risk than even with the flu. So all that being said, it just has that feeling of watching that press conference of it's just kind of bad news piled on top of bad news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you noted at the beginning, initially, this was all about flattening the curve so as not to overwhelm the healthcare system, not to completely eradicate the virus. The virus will be here. And so that's why there's the focus on vaccines and therapies. But we have to be able to get people to get back to work. And so you think about companies like Costco and other just local grocers who have been able to effectively mitigate the risks for people visiting their locations. And I feel like a lot of retail and restaurants at reduced capacities can begin to do that very soon. I'm not saying immediately open up the entire economy right now, but like you likened this to a tortoise earlier, this certainly feels like we're moving at an excessively slow pace. That doesn't seem to match the science. And we keep hearing people say, follow the science, follow the science. Well, it seems like the science is indicating that we're moving on a right trajectory. And so long as people continue to observe common sense social distancing and hygiene habits, we can largely continue on that right trajectory, even if we start to reopen parts of the economy, from what I can tell, at least.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I've read a lot of articles from Europe, and I know some of those countries over there, like Sweden and Germany, are doing, you know, not closing things down, but taking mitigation risks instead of kind of clinging, where it seems like some of these politicians, and Cooper to some extent, I won't accuse him of that entirely watching the press conference, but it seems like some of the focus is still on eradication. I mean, that's why he uses vaccines and some of these other measures and brings them up in the press conferences, that eradication seems like to be the goal with some of these stay-at-home orders. And that's not coming. And now he did mention that it's not going to be eradicated to the vaccine. But I think we need to move on to some mitigation-type assessment with this virus rather than focusing on just trying to eliminate it. And that's really the best path forward. Like you said, it's a balance. People aren't going to survive long-term in this state. There's lots of folks in, whether it be retail and certain aspects of retail, certainly restaurants, hospitality, trade, they're just not going to survive, especially when things may not get back to normal to some degree until July here in this state. You know, that looks like a best case scenario. So, following Cooper's guidelines, at least.
Yeah. And here's a number that, you know, people talk about this, you know, protecting lives, the social distancing. But there's another another competing figure that we also need to consider. And I'm getting this from thegazette.com. It's an article that I'm reading in here by Paul Prentice. And he writes that numerous economic studies show a high correlation between poverty and mortality and between unemployment and mortality. Estimates range from a low of 10,000 additional deaths per percentage point increase in unemployment to a high of 40,000. Suicides increase dramatically. The incidence of drug abuse and alcohol abuse rises dramatically. Crimes against persons and property increase, and critical medical care is postponed or canceled. And so these are other figures that go along with the economic downturn. And so people that make these bad faith arguments that this is putting money before lives aren't considering the impact that an economic depression or recession has on lives as well. And so it's not an easy fix, no matter what. There's no magic silver bullet, but we have to begin to grapple with these difficulties and understand that lives and livelihoods don't need to be pitted against one another.
No, I think that's exactly the right point to make. You're right. I mean, there's so many things that you can measure out from what's going on today that's going to have long-lasting effects, even beyond this virus and how it impacts the virus impacts our cultures and society. But having these stay-at-home orders, having so many businesses shuttered, the long-lasting impacts are going to be just, you're going to be able to see, I think, effects from that from decades, whether it be potential, and pray not, but it's, you know, it's going to happen to some degree, but potential suicides from businesses that have been eradicated, from livelihoods that have been eradicated, from, you know, economic well-being that has been eradicated, from people just kind of going in despair, potentially turning to other types of abuses to mitigate the pain in their lives. You're going to see all these long-lasting impacts from this this virus. And one of the things we were talking about today earlier at Civitas was the potential of states asking for bailouts, which I think will be an economic disaster, not only for this country, but future taxpayers. We're already in of a hell of a mess when it comes to the debt and the federal government potentially bailing out states for many of these problems that are unrelated to this virus, even with the pension problems that states are so far underwater. And so if we're going to start bailing out states, that's ridiculous, in my opinion. And what's going to happen is we're going to have, you know, kind of a new era of poverty and states mismanaging their budgets because the federal government will come in and bail them out. And that's going to be incentivized. There's going to be all kinds of perverse incentives that are going to be exacerbated through this whole experience. So those are some of my fears. So I think you're right. I mean, long-term consequences, we have to take that into consideration instead of just letting some, not all, but some public health officials be the only ones that get to make decisions going forward. And while we respect scientists and we completely put so much trust in them, we also understand that they're not in agreement, like you mentioned. I mean, I'm reading articles about different strategies that are being used in Europe for mitigation. And, you know, not every scientist attached to government is in agreement in those areas. So it is. And I'm just getting back to Cooper's press conference. To me, it just seemed unclear a little bit what the path is and how do we hit all these benchmarks and what happens if we don't hit these benchmarks? I mean, how much further is the delay going to be and how catastrophic are the economic consequences piled on top of that going to really, I think, just kind of kill the spirit of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't want to weigh you all down with doom and gloom and negativity, but these are just the realities on the ground right now. And I think we need to ask some difficult questions of our leadership, whether regardless of what party they belong to. This is an issue that has a lot of implications for every single one of us, and whether it's emotional, physical, financial. And so we need to get out of this state of emergency as quickly as possible, while still being mindful of safety protocols and mitigation strategies to protect the lives of vulnerables. So that's that. And you know, speaking of lives of vulnerables, I don't know, Ray, have you seen this new Harvard study that is coming out that tries to paint children of homeschoolers as vulnerable citizens that need to be protected from their parents by the state.
Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous.
So Harvard Magazine published a piece. It's called The Risks of Homeschooling. And it is an interview with a professor at Harvard named Elizabeth Bartholet. And she teaches law and family at the law school's child advocacy program. And she has come out swinging against homeschooling and made some wildly ridiculous claims. And as a homeschool graduate myself and someone who homeschooled my children, and one of mine is still homeschooled, I just was incredulous by this. It's crazy. So let's go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Well, my favorite part was the art. Did you see the art that accompanied the article with the little girl behind the bars? It had all the, you know, kids that went to go to public schools are outside playing, and it says, what did it say? Reading, writing,
arithmetic, and Bible.
Had the Bible, of course, which is a negative connotation in the photo. But
arithmetic is spelled wrong, but never mind that.
Well, that's probably to show homeschoolers don't know how to spell arithmetic, Brooke.
Yeah, that must be what it is.
When I worked at the Acting Institute, I managed a lot of interns in the that were writing. And one of the things I noticed, the ones that were homeschooled, or I'll say the ones that went to Catholic schools too, they were very good writers. They knew how to communicate. I didn't notice a lot of social anxiety or any of these sort of social, you know, stereotypes that had to do with socialization. They were good communicators. Homeschoolers I come across are generally very smart. There's always exceptions, but they were generally very smart. They're interested in American history, which I think is important. I think if you want to understand a lot of current events today, you need to understand American history, because you see a lot of these things repeating themselves. A lot of trends in this country continually repeat themselves. And so homeschoolers have a good understanding of the world. They have a good understanding of culture and society, which I think is missing from a lot of public school children. So I just don't get the effort to bash homeschoolers. I mean, we're not like in the early 1990s anymore, where some of those stereotypes may have been, at least maybe not true, but maybe a little more prevalent in the culture. I think homeschoolers have overcome a lot of those stereotypes as they've grown up.
Oh, yeah.
Up and, they've become productive members of society.
That's the thing. So I've been exposed to a lot of homeschool cultures. And yes, you see some of the more like fundamentalist sort of approach.
Long jean skirt and all
that. Yeah, the long jean skirts.
How many of those
and
did you own, Brooke? Just
my closet was chock full of them. I had the faded long jean skirts.
The long jean skirts.
I was not the typical homeschooler of the 90s, I'll tell you that much. I was very much ahead of my time, I'll have you know. But so yes, there are those excesses in homeschooling culture, as with any culture, I would say. And by excesses, I'm kind of being silly here, because a lot of that revolved around suppressing girls, especially. It was a patriarchal culture in some of the underbellies of some of the weird homeschool movements. But nonetheless, but homeschooling at large, I would say, has been increasingly secularized, which is also interesting. So I homeschooled my kids in Washington State, and we were part of a secular homeschool group, even though we're a strong Christian family. But I joined that group just because there weren't a lot of like Christian homeschool groups over there. So we would do, we would do science classes with atheists and unschoolers and Mormons, you know, so there was very pluralistic. But the argument that this professor from Harvard makes is that one benefit of sending your children to school at age 4 or 5 is that teachers are mandated reporters required to alert authorities to evidence of child abuse or neglect. And so this is where things get really hairy, is that she's coming from a perspective that presuming that all parents are guilty until proven innocent. And so she's already assuming the worst about parents. And like I just cited, there's some homeschoolers that definitely subscribe to more of this Bill Gothard patriarchal culture sort of thing that that I don't think is healthy for young girls especially. And then there are those people that actually abuse their kids that are hiding under homeschooling. But there are also people that are abusing their kids in public schools. So to use that as the argument to ban homeschooling just doesn't hold water, not to mention it's a rarity. And if we're going to talk about child abuse rates, they're starting to go up. Why? Because more of the kids that are in traditional school environments are now at home with their parents who used to send them to school so that they could have some space from them because they were mentally disturbed themselves. So
right. There's a lot of kids in not good home environments. And that was one of the, I think, more depressing articles I've read in this whole self-quarantine or time at home period is article I think that was written for a Texas newspaper. I don't remember exactly which one, but it was talking about child services and all the depressing cases in Texas because a lot of these kids are not in good home environments and the public schools were safer situations for them. And home just wasn't good. But I think when you're looking at homeschoolers, it's a different environment because they're used to this environment more. They're used to being at home, at least during the day more. So, you know, they're firing on all cylinders at this time now, and it's a much more healthy and thriving environment. And you made a really good point, Brooke. I mean, homeschooling now is a very eclectic mix. It's not just sort of this fundamentalist Christian environment like it may have been 30, 20 years ago, to at least a larger extent than it is today. It's just such an eclectic environment. And I know Bob and I at least have written about this some on Civitas Institute site. It's so different. And the ultimate question when we really get to this is who do your children belong to? And there's some progressives in education that ultimately believe that your children really belong to the state. The state is the best caretaker. The state is the best for guiding your children. And we know as conservatives and we know as believers, no matter really what your faith is, but if you have a deistic formula to your faith, then you know that you are ultimately the best caretaker of your child or children. And I think that's something that we need to always push back against when it comes, wherever you send your kid to school. And so that's a very important point. And just to attack homeschoolers, it seems like such an easy target. But the good news, Brooke, is that there are a lot more homeschoolers out there now and they can hit back hard.
Oh, yeah.
They have evidence, they have data. I mean, people pointed out the standardized test score on homeschoolers are higher. So there's all this data now to debunk these myths and these sort of lies that people do and write just for ideological reasons, either to get attention or to get pats on the backs from fellow academics or fellow professors at their institutions in bashing homeschooling. But, you know...
they've awakened a sleeping giant.
Right. I met far outweigh from an academic standpoint in a... even an adjustment standpoint, than sort of your average public school kid. And there's great kids in public school. There's obviously great teachers. We've talked about that ad nauseum. But, you know, there's so many homeschoolers that just impress me. Maybe they'll be a little nerdy and maybe you can poke fun at them. But how many kids? I've met kids that are in sixth and seventh grade. They're reading Dante's Inferno. I didn't even hear about that till I was like after I graduated from college.
That's the thing, and I love they were probably classically homeschooled, and so I love seeing the resurgence in classical education. The homeschool world has really spearheaded that in a lot of ways, is this resurgence to asking good questions, understanding that education is about forming the loves of a person. And so there's just so much beauty to it. And I am the first person to say that homeschooling isn't the right fit for every family. There are great education options out there in our state, and we have the freedom to choose those, and I celebrate that, regardless of where a parent comes down on what's the best for their kids. But North Carolina has the largest homeschooling population in the United States, by double the second place contender, which is Arkansas. So we have, I think, 7.6% homeschooling population in our state.
Sounds right.
And we've been able to access so many different resources as a result of that. I mean, my children, we were constantly having to say no to extra activities and enrichment opportunities. And that was just because of such a strong, thriving homeschool culture in our state. And I'm so grateful for that. You know, and so just at the end of the day, what really bothered me was that there was this presumption of guilt that parents were naturally abusers of their children, and that the only reason someone would homeschool their kids is because they didn't have their best interest at heart. And that just infuriates me as someone who knows that utterly to be just a farce. And, you know, it's an attack against homeschoolers that is untrue. Will there be abusers in any institution? Yes. And that's why it's our job to weed them out and to make sure that we get law enforcement involved. But that's a problem that is, you know, that goes through every human institution, not just homeschooling. And so for her to attack it like that was something very upsetting. But, you know, I've thankfully seen a lot of responses online to her ridiculousness, and they're taking her task on it. So she's not getting away with it. That's for sure.
I mean, Tim Tebow is homeschooled. He's a world-class athlete, and he's got a supermodel now, you know?
Yeah.
Try to come back with that, Brooke. I mean, try to debunk that.
I mean, yeah, Tim Tebow and me both were supposed to be supermodels, but yeah, he ended up
succeeding. Isn't he married a supermodel?
I don't know. I have no clue. I do not follow sports figures, but I do know who Tim Tebow is. I just don't keep up with his life anymore.
Gotcha. Well, he's either married or is marrying a homeschooler, so he's obviously not very socially awkward. I'm sorry.
No, he's not. Clearly. Not socially awkward enough to get a model to say no to him. So,
all right.
Well, I think we're out of time this week. And, I mean, I love ending on a good homeschooling diatribe.
Absolutely. So. And, yeah, I think just kind of looking forward, we're going to be here. We're going to explain more of this on the stay-at-home order and where we're headed in North Carolina. What will be interesting is there's the reopen North Carolina protests. It looks like they're going to be happening every Tuesday for a while now. So it'll be interesting to see if that grows, if that diminishes, what the response to that is statewide. That'll be something for people to watch. And I know probably some of our listeners are involved in that. So we'll keep an eye on that. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that more too.
Yeah, that sounds good. You guys stay safe out there. We wish you the best, and we look forward to talking to you next week.
Thanks a lot.